Development Leadership with Ted Neuward.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, and all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. If you are running a .NET or Azure-related user group, reach out. I've been doing a lot of online virtual presentations and love to get on your calendar. Our top sponsor is ClearMeasure, and they make this podcast happen. They're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient, able to deliver world-class results, and overall, be awesome. So if they can help, please get in touch, and also be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. Now, our guest today is a repeat guest and is none other than Ted Neuward. He's the Director of Technology Culture at Quicken Loans, and if you've been around the industry for a while, you've no doubt heard his name, read some of his material. But Ted, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic, fantastic. We're having enviable 50s and 60s weather here in Texas and getting ready for the summer, which is not going to be comfortable, but that's okay.
Well, it's actually sunny here in Seattle today.
Ooh.
Although I say that because the sun came out in about the last hour or so, which means probably by 3 hours from now, it'll be back to being gray and dreary and
there's a hole in the clouds. That.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just the way it is here, right? It rains at night, cloudy in the morning, clears up, kind of nice in the afternoon. That's kind of our spring. And then it clouds over and starts raining again in the evening. So yeah. You don't like the weather in Seattle, just wait an hour.
And it'll change.
Yep, exactly.
Although, does it change? I thought it was known for just being kind of gray.
Well, I mean, there's so much moisture in the air that it's that gray. There's lots of clouds and whatnot. Yeah. And then it'll part and then the sun will come in. But that's part of the reason why it's such a temperate zone here. Right.
Yeah,
there is so much consistency. And so it rarely drops below 35 and it rarely gets above 85. And that's part of the reason why we like it here.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, we had a couple of years ago, it broke a 7 year super hot drought, like 7 years straight drought in Texas. And since then, the summers haven't been as bad. And I'm thinking maybe we could get some of that global cooling. That would definitely be useful here. I know up north in Canada and Northeast, you know, they're like, no, too much snow.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah. The worst part of it is, you know, if the various climate change models, mostly one consistent thing is they seem to be emphasizing more of whatever it is you currently get. So if you're north, you get more rain, more snow, more cold. If you're, you know, south for us, right, you get closer to the equator, it's more heat, more dry, less whatever. And so Texas gets to bake even hotter and Seattle gets to drown even more.
Nice.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But I suspect that we're not here to talk about the weather as much fun as it is.
Right. I'm excited to have you back on the show because you have seen so many things and been in so many different situations. And the listeners here, I mean, our industry has exploded over the last 7 years, twice as many people writing code as there was 7 years ago, according to the Stack mm-hmm. Overflow survey. And so, 7 years ago, if we talk about anything that happened 8 years ago, guarantee that half of the people listening were not even in the industry to experience right. that. And so we need to kind of talk about history and the trends and what has happened and things the industry has tried and didn't quite work or things that did work, and as opposed to just, you know, inventing it all over again. So, being the Director of Technology Culture at Quicken Loans, first of all, why don't you tell us what that is and what Quicken Loans does and what kind of developer organization it is, just so we can ground ourselves.
So Quicken Loans, contrary to popular misconception, is not actually a part of Quicken, the personal finance product. So we have nothing to do with TurboTax or with the software that people use to manage their check account. Quicken Loans is actually, I think, better known by our stage name, which is Rocket Mortgage. So if you were watching the Super Bowl this year and you saw Tracy Morgan talking about being certain, certain is better than probably, that's us. That's our company. We do mortgage. Now, officially, Quicken Loans is one of a family of companies, which we've referred to as the FOC, which includes Rocket Auto, Rocket Homes, Rocket Loans, a variety of other financial-related kinds of products. But by far and away, the 800-pound gorilla of that is Quicken Loans. And obviously, as you can well imagine, this has so far been, it's been a pretty good year for us the past 12 months as the real estate market has just gone through the roof. And technology culture as a team was formed about a year ago. The now CIO, as he entered into that role, somebody that I'd been working for in a previous capacity within QL, said, I need a team that is focused around the people, right? Normally, we talk about the triad in the software world as people, process, and technology. Well, we had some folks focused on some of the technology in terms of an architecture group. We had some folks focused around the process in terms of what we call our tech operations team. We have an HR department, what we call the Pulse, but they're focused on HR across all of Quicken Loans. So all the bankers and all of the various operation support and documents and et cetera, et cetera. And there were a lot of things with respect to the people inside of the technology group inside of QL that really needed some care and feeding. This is very common with technology teams. Somebody has an idea about how we should revise our interviewing practices. And so they go and they work with HR to revise those practices, to try to eliminate bias, to do a better job of ascertaining technical skill, et cetera, et cetera. But they're doing it as a side job. They're not actually, that's not their principal focus. That's not what they're paid to do. And quite similarly, in my previous role, the director of platform strategy, I was getting engaged in some of these same kinds of things, interviewing and what do we do around training and mentoring and so forth. And, Brian, my leader, said, you know what? You're doing all these things and I'm not even paying you to do it. What happens if I pay you to do it?
Nice.
And I said, all right, challenge accepted. So we formed the tech culture group. And in the span of a year, we've grown to be about 24 people, a variety of different teams working on those kinds of initiatives, including ways in which we can write some software to make, for example, our recruiters more effective. How do we scale their ability to go out and source, people from, from email campaigns, from LinkedIn, from, and source them accurately so that they're not reaching out to you, Jeff Palermo, and saying, hey, we've got a quality assurance engineer role here in, South Bend, Indiana, we think you'd be great for, because we all of us get those emails. And that just tells you that some recruiter wasn't paying attention and you're on some bulk
mass email. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of those kinds of things that I'm directing, to use the title director. And it's a hell of a lot of fun. It's actually more fun than I ever thought it would be, to be very blunt, because it's the most non-technical role I think I've had in 30 years. Because there are some teams that are writing code, but the only time I write code these days is either because I'm working on, a code sample for a lecture or a conference talk I'm getting ready to do, or because I'm just
perfect
farting around
on
a weekend playing with something. Right.
Well, you're the type of guy where there's a lot of people who listen, just heard that statement. A lot of people who love programming, just absolutely love programming, stay up late at night. I'm like, man, I never want to be like that. That sounds terrible.
Irony here, Jeff. 25 years ago, mm-hmm. I said exactly those same words.
We all do. So I guess talking to the person who's, 1 to 5, maybe 1 to 10 years into the career, who's saying that, no, later on in life, you were You were the product of whatever your fingers could connect into the computer through the keyboard. And mm-hmm. now you're making lots of coders productive as opposed to just you being productive.
Right.
What does that look like though? What do you think about and how do you even measure? How do you even know, oh, I'm actually being effective. I can see that they're being more productive.
It's hard. It really is hard. And interestingly enough, you know, within QL, we spend a lot of time talking about OKRs, objectives and key results. This is one of the later management-y kinds of things for, you know, how to set direction and know that we're accomplishing it. You know, there are lots of different ways to do that. Previous generation of this was KPIs, key performance indicators. And, you know, it's not just the technical folks who love their three-letter acronyms. Let's just call that out right now.
So do y'all go by the, we want to accomplish such and such as measured by this number?
We try. There's a variety of different ways to try to track those sorts of things. And the form doesn't matter so much as the intent, right? I mean, realistically speaking, if I want to spin up a mentoring program inside of the company, for example, how do I measure the success of that program, right? Now, it would be great if we were all in one giant role-playing game and I could look at your programming skill as a 0 to 100 number and see if you've increased a couple of points on that. Unfortunately, no such objective measurement of one skill is available to us. So we have to use far more subjective ways. And in some cases, they can be, you know, they can be either extremely lagging indicators, right? So, you know, if you do, for example, if your company does an annual employee survey and you ask questions like, you know, do you feel supported in your job? Well, if the survey comes out in January and I start the program in February, I've got a whole 11 months for that to really have some form of an impact. And that's both good and bad because number one, people may be really excited by it for the first 3 or 4 months and then all of a sudden discover that it conflicts with some other things. You know, some people do it, other people don't. And so the impact of that is lost by the time the next January survey comes around, right? The flip side of it is if I announce it in December and we have the survey in January, well, lots of people may say, oh yeah, I feel very supported because here's this mentoring program. But that's because they've all just signed up for it and they don't realize that the program actually is terrible. And they don't actually, you know, so it looks like a huge success when it's not. And so you really, within this, within the people space in particular, it's hard to identify some of those metrics, some of those key results that you can use to kind of guide and determine whether or not the program is successful. But you still have to make the effort. You still have to make some kind of attempt to identify, you know, is this useful? Because the flip side is, cool, I'm going to hire, you know, 50 to 100 people to sit around and do a bunch of things that don't actually affect anything. I mean, truthfully, for a lot of companies, we call them HR, right?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, so it's an interesting challenge, but it's a very, very different challenge from what certainly, you know, if you're a programmer and you're thinking, oh my gosh, those are all the kinds of things that I want to stay away from. Well, there are parts to every job that nobody really cares for. Let's just call that spade a spade. But they are a necessary part of the job, particularly because if you want to really have the impact, you know, we talk about 10X programmers, but realistically speaking, the 10X kind of multiplicative effect far more often occurs with management than it does with development. And so if you put a good manager in charge of a team, you can get that 10X productivity increase, even if none of the individual developers are 10X. And that's where the real win comes from.
That's a sacred cow. Dig into that more because we all hear people saying 10X, and then there's people who self-declare that they are 10X, who may or may not be, or may just be the most arrogant person in the room. And then there's other people who are humble as all get out, but maybe they cause everybody else to jump up a mm-hmm. couple multipliers whether they're management or not. Yep. So what are some of those things a manager can do to just like a whole bump up a whole notch the effectiveness of their team.
Well, this is where we start getting into some of the concepts of servant leadership. And if you're not familiar with the concept, the idea is that as a leader, you are there to serve your team. Many people believe that management is about bossing people around, giving them direction. And yeah, there are times when you're going to have to make some decisions. You're going to have to give some direction. You're going to have to give some guidance and say, you know, this is where we want to go. That's the hill we want to take. This is the company that we want to take on this time around. And so, you know, this is, again, the OKRs are born out of Andy Grove and the way in which he did his management style at Intel, the most famous of which is what he called Operation Crush, which was short for Crush Motorola. When the Motorola chips were starting to make inroads into the PC market, Andy Grove mustered a significant amount of energy and focus and resources within Intel to meet Motorola head on and demonstrate that the PC was actually, the 8086 chip was a better chip line than the Motorola 68000, which was the chip at the time. You know,
and the reason that most of you listeners don't know that Motorola chip's name is because Intel won.
By far and away won, right? But the Motorola chip, the 68000 chip, was actually the predecessor to the x86 that's inside of the Macs now. And it was because Intel won and they were able to demonstrate better benchmarking, better engineering life cycle, better power consumption, I mean, just every metric they could think of, they championed it. And part of what Grove did was not tell people exactly what benchmarks to run or how to run the marketing campaign, but to muster everybody's energy and focus in one direction and then look for any obstacles that might come up in that would prevent that focus and squash those obstacles. Because that's really what you do as a leader is you say, team, I want us to do X. And then you answer questions about what that means. You give them the ability to go execute on that. You know, this is where you get into the, you know, giving them the why, giving them the explanation for why you want to go after that so they can make it their own as opposed to just something that they're doing because you said so. You know, get them to buy into that vision, get them to see it and make it a part of their own vision, and then sweep the floors if you have to. I mean, that's the definition of a servant leader is the, you know, the one
that doesn't. The upside down org chart.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously none of us are sitting physically in rooms anymore, but once we get back to sitting in rooms, you know, if I'm having a team on site and my team is brainstorming on something and somebody needs to start collecting the pizza boxes or go out and grab lunch, more pizzas, et cetera, you know, yeah, I'm not going to interrupt my team and have somebody else do that. No, I'm going to step out. I'm going to make that happen because really, I am no longer the principal contributor of value. My team is. And so everything I should be focused on is how to make my team successful.
Yeah. Well, that's the same thing physically in a manufacturing plant. Yeah, the line level workers, the people who you would think of as the individual contributors, they're on the manufacturing line. But if one of them stops to go pick up the pizza boxes, well, now production throughput is impacted versus management who's supervising. Oh, let's go pick up the pizza boxes. Keep the lines moving.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that it's an important realization because many people, I think, you know, that as a developer, you look up the org chart. Right. And you say, oh, wow, being a team lead means I get to make all of these really cool technology decisions. I get to decide which direction we go. Yeah, I want to be one of those because of the power. Mm-hmm. And then they get to that team lead role and realize how severely constrained they are by other expectations by their leader. Right. And all the way up to CIO, CTO, where you think, finally, I'm at the pinnacle of the pyramid, but you realize that you're still constrained. You're constrained by the fact that your business is going in a direction and your CEO wants to do these additional things. And you have all of these constraints around, you know, budget and what your team members are doing. And you've got all these programmers who keep insisting that the whole stack should just be rewritten in Elixir. And, you know, you're like, no, seriously, just stop and focus on this one problem.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Can we stop and just address that real quick? Because I'm so cognizant of people who are probably in their first situation where they're thinking, oh, we should just rewrite this, regardless if it's new technology or what. You just said that in passing, but that's like a big thing in the industry that every, you go into some system that you didn't write, you look at it and you're going to quickly start lobbying the powers that be. Oh, we need to replace this. We need to rewrite this. And that's seldom, almost never, the right business answer. Well, talk about why people advocate for that and why it's such a bad thing.
So the main reason that people advocate for it, very bluntly, is because we mistake our own lack of comprehension for actual technical acceptability, right? So you, Jeffrey Palermo, you get hired by a company, you start working with a given code base. There's all kinds of things here in this code that you just don't understand. You just don't, I mean, why in the hell do they do it this way? This seems counterintuitive to the way you have a mental model in your head as to the way things should work, right? And that's with a capital T, capital S, and capital W, right? The way things should work. And the code that you're looking at doesn't fit that mental model. And so you're saying, well, it doesn't fit my mental model. Clearly, it must not fit anybody else's mental model, or else they're all just suffering from Stockholm syndrome or something. Right? Clearly, the code is wrong. Obviously. It's not you that's wrong. And this is where I'm going to channel a little bit of my philosophy background and start telling you to think about Lord Chesterton's fence. And this is a trope. This is a common idea that says, if you wander into the middle of the field and you see a fence and there is no discernible reason why this fence should be there, you might want to ask around why this fence was constructed before you knock it down, lest you all of a sudden discover that your herds have mixed with your neighbor's herds, and now all of a sudden you get into a shooting war because you think they're stealing your sheep and they think that you're stealing their sheep, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lord Chesterton's fence basically says that if something is there, at least at some point in time, it was done that way for a reason. You need to embrace the idea that if you have a coworker who wrote this absolute terrible code, they wrote this code because it was the best answer they had at the time for the problem that was in front of them, and not just because they're terrible programmers. You need to trust your teammates. You need to believe that they were trying to do the best possible thing, just as you would want them to believe that in you, right? This is sort of an extension of the whole do unto others principle, right? Believe of others what you would have them believe of you. And that trust is so lacking, particularly across organizational units. Code gets tossed over the fence from another team, and you look at it and you're like, oh my God, what the hell? I thought these people were smart. And God help us all if it was a team of consultants or contractors, right? Then, oh yeah, you know, it's a very common trope. As a consultant, I would walk into engagements and tell people, by the way, I'm here so that you have somebody to blame for all the crappy code when I leave, even if I never wrote that code. I'm the one to blame. That's the whole reason I get paid a ton of money, is so that you can blame me when I'm gone.
Yeah.
And so part of this is because you don't know all of the decisions. You don't know the reasons behind the decisions, partly because we only document the code as it is. We don't document the code that we decided it not to be, right? We chose not to use this particular pattern, or we chose not to use this particular language or this particular platform because of these concerns. And unfortunately, by not documenting those things, somebody else comes along and says, oh, hey, why didn't we do this all in Elixir? You're not, unless you were there in the room when we made that decision 2 years ago to not use Elixir, nobody knows. It's like, oh, well, clearly they just didn't know about it, right? Because it's kind of new and it's kind of, you know, kind of fringe and kind of off there in the corner. And yeah, they just didn't know. So we should totally do a pilot. And hopefully it's just a pilot, not a complete rewrite,
right?
Because it's ridiculously expensive. Forget the actual time to rewrite the system. It's ridiculously expensive to retool all of the developers who are going to work on it to make sure that it's bug for bug compatible with the previous version. Otherwise, you have to retrain your users to the new bugs that you introduced and the old bugs that now no longer hold, which they have developed procedural workarounds for. And don't even try to tell me that the new system won't have any bugs, because that just really, really tells me that you just don't have a freaking clue, because there's always going to be bugs that are coming in.
Well, and anybody who objects to that statement or encountering that for the first time, I'll just make a pitch for Capers Jones's research. Capers Jones, he's probably the most prolific publisher of research around bug trends by project, by language, and all that. And there's just a wealth of information he's consolidated. So you don't have to go and consolidate it yourself. Just grab a couple of his latest books.
Oh, it's you know, it's funny because you alluded to earlier, Jeff, the idea that, you know, there's all this history, there's all these cycles, right? These people who have, you know, 8 years ago, 8 years ago, 2012, surprise, it wasn't all that different from the industry we have in front of us now, right? Yeah. Everybody believes that, you know, oh, mobile totally, you know, changes the world and this new language is totally, no, son.
Oh, it's just a computer with a smaller screen that you can stick in your pocket.
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
and Fred Brooks's Mythical Man Month book and the series of essays, and back in university, that was required reading when I went through in the late 90s. And he published that book after his first project, what, I think, 1959, and then his career. And then he revised the book in 2001 with a new preface. And I'll summarize what the preface said. Yeah, I was still right.
Yeah.
After 20 years after the book.
Yep.
And I would say 20 years after that in 2021, I think it's still right. All the things.
In many respects, we keep making the same mistakes, partly because we keep failing to heed the words of Carlos Santillana, the historian, right? I'm sorry, George Santillana. Carlos Santana, he's the guitar player.
That's
George
Santillana,
the historian, saying those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Condemned to repeat it.
Yeah. And this is the reason for history. And this is actually, this opens up a new rant, because this is actually one of the things that I think we're doing ourselves a gross, gross disservice by not stressing the power of the liberal arts, even within computer science. Historians are there to document the past so that we can examine the past and draw inferences and avoid making the same mistakes, right? There's obvious parallels here. You know, Napoleon and Hitler, both invading Russia, both made similar kinds of mistakes, you know, and there's a lot of nuance that goes with that. But at the end of the day, this is the power of history. Without somebody capturing those historical decisions, without capturing that historical record, you don't have the ability to go back and learn from the mistakes that we've already made. And this is something that many development teams really don't understand. That if you do go back, there's a great concept called architectural decision records. A buddy of mine, Michael Nygaard, has blogged about this a couple of years ago, I think, and talked about it. Simon Brown, who's another architect.
Yeah, the inventor of the C4 model for architectural diagrams.
He's talked about ADRs as well. And whether you follow the format of the ADR or you do something differently, it can be just as important to document what you chose not to do as it is to document what you chose to do. And in some cases, it's more important to document what you chose not to do, because the code will tell you what you did, but there's no other artifact.
What options you considered.
Yeah, exactly.
And if people are thinking that's overhead, how often do you think that teams make true architectural decisions, it's not every day, right?
3 to 4 years.
You're saying you think once every 3 to 4 years?
Oh, yeah. Once every 3 to 4 years. Well, let me back up.
Architecture, I mean, new products, it would be, you know, a lot up front, obviously. But then as a product goes through, you don't make sweeping changes very frequently.
Well, depends on how you approach your architecture, right? In some cases, your architecture evolves as opposed to being, you know, architected. It sort of passively emerges if you don't spend much time thinking about it up front. So in that sense, yeah, technically, every time you decide to open a database connection, you are making an architectural decision, because if everybody makes the same decision, you end up with 27 simultaneous database connections and you crush your database. Yeah. So in that sense, yeah, you could argue that architectural decisions are being made every day, because in many respects, architecture is that set of decisions that developers, you make this set of decisions ahead of time that developers normally make in their day-to-day. Right? When and how do I structure my code so that it's more easily testable, et cetera, et cetera. Arguably, those are all architectural decisions. But some of the other things that we think of as architectural decisions, like we're going to use the .NET platform, or we're going to use Python, or we're going to use JavaScript, those don't happen every day, certainly. Right. But yeah. Roughly speaking, right, if you have a team of developers and they're working on a product and you know, today in 2021, they made the decision to use C# and .NET. I can absolutely guarantee you that by 2024, somebody on that team is going to say, hey, why aren't we using Java? Why aren't we using Node? Why aren't we using insert other platform here for this particular problem? And nobody on that team will have been around in 2021 to be able to describe why we're doing .NET. And so now that team is going to have to go through the gyrations of rediscovering why they chose to do .NET back in 2021. And in that, that's roughly a 3 to 4 year cycle, because that's twice the length of the average length of stay in any particular role in the industry. On average, I will change jobs 22 months. Now, that's a very old survey, but it definitely seems to be holding true with a lot of companies. Too. And so twice that, and you've got an entirely new team.
Yeah. And there's a lot of architectural changes that tend to be reactionary as well. Like up front, you're building something new. Okay, you throw in a bunch of hypotheses. I think we should do this. It's all guesses, some more educated than others.
All bets.
But then once you're in production, like invariably you throw up some web services and then one of them's like, oh shoot, what just happened? Well, one web service call end up eating a whole bunch of CPU on a server. Okay, we need to factor out that, because that tends to be unpredictable. And well, okay, that, you know, that's a reactionary architecture change. And then someone later on is like, why is that his own web service? Why not just put it in with the rest of them?
Yeah. I mean, it's a giant circus wheel. That's the thing that you will discover the longer you're in this space, is we do these giant circus wheels, right? We go from dynamically typed languages to statically typed languages back to dynamically typed. We've done that circus wheel several times in the last several
years. Was it 2005 to 2008? Yep. Everyone's like, you have to be dynamic. Static languages suck.
And you have now to be Ruby. Like, it's like Ruby. It was all Ruby. Yeah,
whatever
all the
happened
time.
To that?
Yep. And now it's Python. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a certain point, this is where I've earned all the gray in my beard and in my hair. It's like, yeah, I've been through several of those cycles. And I can tell you, you know, I remember when Java was new and I was coming off of being a C++ developer. And there were several projects that I, you know, was a part of that said, we need to rewrite the whole thing we take the C++ code and write the whole thing in Java. Why? Well, because Java's better. Yeah, but why? What actual value do we deliver to anybody that's not us programmer types?
Especially if it's a desktop app. Why?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why? What value does this deliver? And, because at the end of the day, I challenge anybody. Right, I'm going to point to a random application on either your phone or your desktop, and I'm going to ask you to tell me what it was written in.
Oh, because we can't tell most of the time.
You absolutely can't. There's no way to know, right?
Right. And so many managers are really, I've heard just on the consulting side, you ask them, why'd they choose it? Well, that's what all my people knew. It's the skill set that I had.
And that, as strange as it may sound, that is in fact a very viable reason to choose that particular technology.
Totally, because they're so good these days. All of them are good. They're all so good these days.
Yeah,
you know, if that's the team you have, and they can crank it out.
Well, and that's the thing is once you've mastered language, right? The mythical 10,000 hours to become an expert, right? Mm-hmm. You know that I shouldn't say mythical. That goal.
It's real. It's backed up by some studies. Yeah,
right. That notion, that shelf, that plateau, right? That notion of I get 10,000 hours in something and now I'm an expert in it. I believe you can be an expert in programming languages with far less than 10,000 hours once you've reached that plateau with one language. Because then you can start to, just like it's much easier to learn another spoken language after you've learned your first two or three. If you learn French, it's actually relatively easy to learn Romanian or Italian because they're all Romance languages. But it actually helps you with your English as well because you start spending more time thinking about sentence structure and so on and so on and so on. Same thing happens in programming languages. And I mean, truthfully, pick any project and throw a dart at the dartboard where you have programming languages, right? Ruby, Python, C Sharp, Java, Rust, you know, there's a whole slew of them. There's a really good chance. I mean, I can build desktop applications in JavaScript today. Electron has it there. It's right available to you. There's ways to kick off Chrome off of the local machine to bring up a desktop app. There's ways to do Java on your iPhone. There are tools that will actually do cross-compilation. There's ways to do web on a phone. There's ways to do anything on anything. So if you've got a team and they've already got significant time and skill invested into a given language, you'll have a very, very high bar to get past, in my opinion, if you want to try to change the language or the tooling. There really has to be a compelling reason for it. So pivoting from, you know, if I've got a .NET team and they know C Sharp and we need to start building some mobile applications, I'm going to reach for Xamarin long before I try to teach them Kotlin and Swift. They may eventually need to learn Kotlin and Swift to be able to do some sort of plugin that Xamarin currently doesn't have support for, but that's going to be so far down the road that we will have plenty of time to address that. So,
Yeah,
what actually gets you closer to the goal of shipping something of value? That's actually the real critical factor. And that's the thing that managers really need to be thinking about. Not just what's cool and nifty, but what's going to get me closer to done.
Right. And the most popular, as in the most widespread programming language, is not the same as the programming language that the most lines of code are being written in today in 2021.
Oh, yeah.
Because at some point in time, you know, COBOL was the most prevalent, but nobody wanted to write any more. And according to there's some surveys that just came out for 2021, as far as new code being written, Java dropped off the top 10. For new code being written, the most in-demand programming languages for new applications, new developers, Python ranked number one, C++ number two, VB and C Sharp took the next couple spots, and then JavaScript, PHP right behind it. Objective-C came in at number nine. So it's always changing, but
Java. You have to be a little careful with some of that too, though, because even as Java, the language, may be dropping, the Java platform is growing because you've got all these different languages running on top of
JVM.
The platform,
that's right, JVM.
So you've got Groovy, you've got Scala, you've got Kotlin, right? So the number of lines of Kotlin code is skyrocketing because Kotlin is now the official language for doing Android development, even though Android technically is not a JVM. It was born using the Java.
They copied the language wholesale.
There's a great quote. There's a great aphorism to keep in mind that says there are three kinds of lies in the world. Lies, statistics. Damned lies, and statistics.
Yeah, right. It's totally true. It's certainly myself. I don't consider myself an expert in Java. I've done a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I do consider myself an expert in all the Microsoft languages from 1997 to present day, because that's what I've invested my time in. And you know what? I'd rather leverage that than even go sideways and, you know, try to become an expert in other ones. It's a decision to make. And I think it's a viable decision. And so people early in your career, yeah, just, you gotta pick one that you believe has legs for the next decade and beyond, because that's what you're going to invest in.
Truthfully, any programming language that is being taught in any sort of institution or coding school, it's a good one, right? Yep. JavaScript, yep. Python, Java, .NET, any one of these is a viable platform and language to build a career on. And there is no need to pivot. There's no need to do, until you reach a point where you want to sort of experiment, you know, and explore.
If you want to do embedded devices, you got to learn C. to this day.
Yeah. I mean,
still to this day.
Oh yeah. That's a given. Right. But I don't know how many embedded systems programmers are actually listening to your podcast.
So, right. Well, we did a show on Azure Sphere a couple weeks ago.
Very possible. You
know, IoT.
Yeah, I don't know.
But you're right. The general purpose and web application developers and smartphone develop. Yeah,
yeah.
Tons.
Yeah.
Well, hey, this was a really, really interesting show. And I appreciate you coming on. Ted Neward is the director of technology culture at Quicken Loans. Ted, thanks for coming back to the show. I appreciate it. Is there any resources you want to point the listeners at before we close out?
We definitely wandered through a variety of different topics. So it's kind of hard to think of one that sort of captures it all. The one thing I would say is got a shout out for my employer, Quicken Loans. We're always looking for smart people to join us. Like most companies, we are embracing the remote workforce going forward. So if you're hearing this anywhere within the boundaries of the United States, we have some complications owing to mortgage and tax. We are US bound at the moment, US bound in Canada. Canada is just kind of America's ball cap. So, Richard Campbell will kick me for that one, but
it does have a population the size of Texas.
There you go. So we're always interested, and I can always be reached, tednewart@quickenloans.com, if anybody's got any particular interest. I work pretty closely with the recruiting folks over there. But in general, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, hey, I came in through the collegiate route or through a coding camp, and I'm desperately trying to figure out, you know, how do I stay relevant? The one thing I'll leave you with is one of the tips that Pragmatic Programmer, a book by Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt, one of the best non-technical programming books you will ever read. They advocate learning a new programming language every year. I pivot that slightly. I would say learn a new blank every year. Learn a new language, learn a new database, learn a new platform, learn a new whatever. And it will, even if you never actually use it in your day job, it will help change some of the way you think. It'll help you understand your own programming language better. The other thing I will say is, as much as the industry really stresses to people that they should be doing this on their own time, I would go talk to your leader, go talk to your manager and say, hey, I'd like to spend an hour a week, studying some other language, some other, platform, database, whatever. And if your boss says no, then you might want to seriously question whether or not it's time to move on. Because at the end of the day, if you cannot change your corporate culture, maybe time to change your corporate culture.
Yep. The old adage, hey, change your organization or change your organization.
Yeah, exactly. Alistair Coburn. Gotta love it.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again, Ted. I appreciate it.
All right, man. You take care.
And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.